Siostra.
Just wait for everyone to be seated and we'll begin. Sahana vavatu, sahanao bhunaktu, sahavirjan karava vahai, tejasvinavadhi tamastu ma vidvisha vahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Very good. Welcome back. We're continuing our study of chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita. We'll begin some recitation this morning with the 11th verse. Repeat after me. Shri Bhagavanu Vacha, Shri Bhagavanu Ashochyanan Vashochastvam, Ashochyanan Vashochastvam, Prajnavadam Shabhasate, Prajnavadam Shabhashase, Gata Sunagata Sunscha, Gata Sunagata. Nanu shochanti panditaha, nanu shochanti panditaha, natvevaham jatu nasam, natvevaham na, natvam ne me janadhipaha, natvam ne me janha, na chaiva nabhavishyamaha, na chaiva nabhavishyamaha. Sarve vayamatah param, sarve vayamatah, dehi nosmin yata dehe, dehi nosmin yata, kaumaram yauvanam jara, kaumaram yauvanam, tata dehantara praptir, tata dehantara, dhirastatra namuhyati, dhirastatra namuhyati, matrasparshastu kaunteya, matrasparshastu kaunt, shitoshna sukha dukha daha, shitoshna sukha dukha, agamapayino nityas, agamapayino, Thansitikshasva Bharata, Thansitikshasva Bharata, Yam hi na vyatayan tyete, Yam hi na vyatayan, Purusham Purusharshabha, Purusham Purusharshabha, Samadukha Sukham Dhiram, Samadhukha Dukham Dhiram, Somratatvaya Kalpate, Somratatvaya Kalpate, Nasato vidyate bhavo, nasato vidyate, na bhavo vidyate sataha, na bhavo vidyate, ubhayorapi drishtontas, ubhayorapi drishtontas, tvanayos tattva darshivihi, tvanayos tattva darshivihi, Avinhashi tu tad vidhi, avinhashi tu tad, yena sarvam idam tatam, yena sarvam, vinasham avyayasyasya, vinasham avyayas, nakashchit karatum harhati, nakashchit karatum harhati, antavantahi me deha, antavantahi me deha, Nityasyokta sharirinaha, Nityasyokta sharirinaha, Anashino prameyasya, Anashino prameyasya, Tasmad yudhyasva bharata, tasmad yudhyasva bharata, yahenam veti hantaram, yahenam veti, yashchainam manyate hatam, yashchainam, ubhau tau navijanito, ubhau tau navijanito, Nayam hanti na hanyate, nayam hanti na hanyate. Very good. So, as we continue at the very beginning of the spiritual teachings in chapter 11, in chapter 2, verse 11, where the actual, where Sri Krishna's spiritual message begins. Before we proceed with the with our discussion, on Tuesday, there is a celebration many of you know as Gita Jayanti. I want to speak just very briefly about this and introduce something to share with you. Gita Jayanti, with our children, I was talking about Gita Jayanti, and they said, I said, Jayanti means birthday. And they asked, who's Gita? They're thinking of Gita as a girl's name and wondering. So in this case, it's Bhagavad Gita Jayanti, the birthday, as it were, of the Bhagavad Gita. And we should ask a question, what does it mean for a scripture to have a birthday? It does. What would that birthday be? That birthday would be the day on which that samvada, that dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna took place. So that took place historically on a particular day. That particular day happened to be the first day of the 18-day battle that forms the heart of the Mahabharata. So that is the particular day celebrated as Gita Jayanti, the day historically when this dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna took place. Now, allow me to share with you a story about Gita Jayanti and then share something else with you, special for the occasion. It must be maybe 15, 20 years ago, I was in Delhi. I was staying in Rishikesh, maybe visiting in Delhi. And it was a time of Gita Jayanti. And I went, I don't recall where it was, somebody's home or a temple, and where Gita Parayana was being done on that day. The usual practice to celebrate Gita Jayanti is to chant, to recite all 18 chapters. We considered doing it here, except it takes 2.5 hours to recite the whole of the Bhagavad Gita. So it's a little bit time-taking. But I want to share with you an experience. I had chanted Bhagavad Gita before on other occasions, mostly when I was living at Arsha Vidya Gurukulam in Pennsylvania. But in those days, I was studying Sanskrit. And over the years, my competency in Sanskrit came up to such an extent that when I was in Delhi chanting the entire Bhagavad Gita, it was the first time that the meaning was clear and vivid as I was chanting it. You know, so my Sanskrit level had finally come up to that to that level, so that as I was chanting, the meaning was with me 100%. And tears came to my eyes. It was very, very moving to recite the entire Bhagavad Gita, and I felt so blessed to have had the opportunity to learn the language properly so that I could enjoy this wonderful poetry, spiritual poetry, and have the meaning come so clearly in my mind while we chanted all 700 verses. What that led to years later, I wanted to teach Bhagavad Gita to teenagers. Actually, two things. There's a confluence of two things. One factor was I wanted to teach Bhagavad Gita to a group of teenagers, and teenagers would be pretty much turned off by a lot of Sanskrit verses. So that was one factor that led me to a particular kind of English translation. I started working on a translation, but here's what's unusual about the translation. The translation wasn't just for teens. The translation was also for adults, with adults in mind, because it's a translation in English that's metrical, so that you can chant the translation just like you chant the Sanskrit verses. And the reason for doing this is what, in my experience, most people in our community, they know a little Sanskrit, but not enough to get the full meaning of Bhagavad Gita as they chant it. So I developed this translation so that we all know English. If you don't know English, you wouldn't be here today. So I developed this translation so that we could all chant the Bhagavad Gita in English so that we can get the meaning. And what I'd like to share with you now is just chapter one. It's a nice way to also to summarize what we've already studied. So today we'll chant chapter one. And then after we finish chapter two, then we'll chant the English version of chapter two. After we finish chapter three, etc., etc. And we will begin today. This translation is unique in that it follows the meter of the original Sanskrit. The original Sanskrit is mostly an Anushtubh Chandas, which has eight syllables per quarter. The first verse, Dharma Kshetre Kuru Kshetre, eight. Samaveta Yuyutsavaha Mamaka Pandavashchaiva Kimakurvata Sanjaya. There's also a rhythm of short and long syllables that has to be followed. So look what we've done here. Assembled. In fact, you can repeat after me. You'll see how it follows the same rhythm. Dhritarashtra vacha, assembled on the battlefield, assembled on the battlefield of Dharma, the Kuru's land, field of Dharma, the Kuru's land. There stand my sons and Pandu's sons. What did they do, O Sanjaya? What did they do? Just follows the same meter exactly. So next verse, Sanjaya said, seeing the Pandavas' forces, drawn for battle, prepared for war. Prince Duryodhana then approached. His teacher Drona, and he said, good. I think we can recite together now. Those underlines will kind of help you find your way through the meter. Also, you'll find that some of the verses have been abbreviated. So the 700 verses I felt for teenagers was too much. So it's kind of reduced down. I think it's reduced to about 350, about half. So you'll find that some of the verses have been, they haven't been excluded, but the meanings have been included into the other verses. So shall we chant together to the end of chapter one? Together, please. Behold, O Master, standing here, the mighty troops of Pandu sons, organized by your shrewd pupil, Drishtadyumna, Drupada's son, archers bold who in war can match, even Bhima and Arjuna, Abhimanyu, Virata too, all of them mighty warrior chiefs. O Drona, may you now observe our own warriors illustrious, Bhishma, Karna, Ashwatthama, and Kripa the victorious. Many other heroes stand here who have staked their own lives for me, equipped with weapons of all kinds, highly skilled in the art of war. The strength of our own troops is vast. Bhishma protects them all from harm, but their troops' might is limited. Even though Bhima guards them all, then the conches and kettle drums, cymbals, tabors, and trumpets shrill, all resounded quite suddenly, blaring forth so tumultuous in a glorious chariot to which white stallions had been yoked. stood Lord Krishna and Arjuna. On holy conches they did blow. Yudhishthira. Oops. What happened here? And Bhima too. Abhimanyu and Drupada. Drishtadyumna and Shikhandi. Upon great conch shells they all blew. The hearts of Dhritarashtra's sons were shattered by the dreadful roar, blaring loudly, resounding far through the sky and around the earth. Then seeing Dhritarashtra's sons, their swords raised high, prepared to fight, Arjuna, taking up his bow, addressed Lord Krishna with these words. Arjuna said, O Krishna, steer our chariot between both armies gathered, so I can see those eager to fight, whom I must now engage in war. Sanjaya said, Arjuna then beheld them all, his uncles, teachers, brothers too, nephews, cousins, and grandfathers, sons and grandsons, and friends as well. He surveyed all those gathered near, amassed in armies on both sides. Then with his great compassion stirred, Arjuna said in deep despair, Arjuna said, O Krishna, seeing my own folk here assembled, eager to fight, my body shakes, my limbs fall limp, my mouth is parched, my hair on end, my bow slips from my quaking hand, and my skin seems to burn with fire. My mind is spinning round and round. No longer can I even stand. Our own teachers and relatives, for whom we are prepared to fight, all stand arrayed for battle here, giving up their own lives and wealth. I do not want to slaughter them, even if I am slain instead, since after killing our own folks, how could we live in happiness? How could we not be wise enough to turn back from this dreadful sin by discerning the awful wrong of destroying our family? If our family is destroyed, ancient dharma will perish too. And when the dharma has been lost, a dharma will prevail for all. The social order will decline, and our women will be defiled. Those whose clans are corrupted thus are damned to hell, so we have heard. Oh, alas, we are now prepared to commit such a grievous sin, driven to slay our kith and kin by our greed to reclaim the throne. If Dhritarashtra's well-armed sons were to slay me while I did stand, unarmed, resisting not at all, this would be far better for me. Sanjaya said, Arjuna, having spoken thus, slumped down upon the chariot seat, casting off his arrows and bow, afflicted by great misery. So nice, a good chant. Chapter 1, you get the full meaning very clearly. We'll do this after each chapter. I should mention before we proceed with our class that this is available in book form. There's a blue book over on the counter if you wish to purchase a copy of that. All right. So, and you can see the power of chanting it. That's what I experienced in Delhi so many years ago, was this text is poetry meant to be recited. When you recite a prose version of the Bhagavad Gita, it sounds pretty flat. But when you recite a poetic version of it, it sounds glorious, and that's the power of poetry. So the attempt of this English translation is to embrace that poetic style so we can enjoy that poetic intensity as we chant it. So having done that, this, by the way, is our Gita Jayanti celebration. 10 minutes of chanting, chapter one, because 2.5 hours of chanting all 700 verses is perhaps a little bit more than we're ready for this morning. So we can, however, continue then with our study in chapter two. Let me return. Let's see, we have finished. We started verse 13. Well, we didn't finish verse 13. Let me get back to that. And before we return to the verse, I'd like to return to a discussion we had. These verses can be very confusing if we're not clear about some terminology. In particular, we're talking about the deha and dehi. Deha, body. Dehi is that which indwells the body. But this topic is a little bit more complex than it would appear, because the indweller of the body can be referred to in two very different ways. So one way that we refer to the indweller of the body is as sukshma sharira, loosely translated as soul, and defined as that which travels. But then we differentiated sukshma sharira, which dwells in the body. We also discussed atma, which also dwells in the body. And these terms, sukshma sharira and atma, are not interchangeable. We discussed this last week, but with your permission, I'd like to review that because it's such a crucial topic. And then with this in mind, then we can see the next sequence of verses very nicely. So just to return to that. Thank you. So just to make sure that our understanding is clear, we differentiate between sthula sharira. Sharira means body. Sthula, as we describe, means physical, perceptible, the so-called gross body, physical body. Then we differentiated from that the sukshma sharira, subtle body. And we define subtle very specifically. If sthula is that which you can perceive, sukshma is that which you cannot perceive. Can't feel it, taste, touch, smell it, etc. And the examples we gave is, for example, you have eyeballs. Your eyeballs are physical. Your power of sight is not physical. It's not a thing. It's a capacity. It's a shakti. It's a power. That power belongs to the sukshma sharira. Your eyeballs belong to your physical body. Your power of sight to the sukshma. Your brain, 2.5 pounds of rubbery stuff. Your brain belongs to sthula sharira. Your mind, your thoughts, your emotions belong to sukshma sharira. Your hands, sthula sharira, power of grasping, sukshma sharira. Your heart, sthula sharira, power of circulation, sukshma sharira. Your lungs, sthula sharira, power of breathing, sukshma sharira. You get the idea. So sthula sharira describes your physical body. Sukshma sharira is that which enlivens your body. All of the various factors. We don't want to go into great detail of this. That's more the subject for a Vedanta class. So here we want to stay with the text a little bit more. So the sukshma sharira, includes all those factors which make your body alive. All those non physical factors, all those things which cannot be weighed, cannot be held, cannot be seen or heard. They are subtle, they are imperceptible. And then in our last class, at the end of the last class, we introduced a third factor which we've yet to discuss. We introduced it, but did not discuss it. That third factor is Atma. Atma literally means self, and it is an indwelling self. So if we want, we can make this distinction. Deha, physical body, is sthula sharira, but in our text, dehinosmin, in asmin dehe, in, we saw this in the last class, asmin dehe, in this body, asmin dehe, in this body which is dehinaha, which belongs to the dehin, or better said, dehi. The deha belongs to the dehi, the indweller. And here's the tricky part. What do we mean by dehi? Well, dehi, the indweller, can refer to either of these. If you read the Bhagavad Gita without some Vedantic background, things will get very confusing at this point, which is why we're going to pause before we return to the verse and make sure that this distinction is clear so that we won't get confused as we proceed. We've already discussed sukshma sharira. Now we want to talk about Atma. The most common definition of Atma, as many of you know, sat chit ananda. Sat literally means existent. We're going to talk about each one of these words extensively over the coming weeks and months. We're going to talk very briefly right now. Chit, consciousness. Ananda, fullness. Instead of bliss, the word bliss has some problems with it. We'll talk about it another time. The simplest way of understanding Atma is to focus on that word chit, consciousness. Something we can relate to experientially. Why? Are you conscious of what's happening right now? Yep. Unless you've fallen asleep. I don't think anyone has yet. Not yet. We'll see by the end of the class. All right. Consciousness. You are conscious. Conscious of what? You're conscious of whatever is going on in the lecture hall. You're conscious of what Swami Tadatmananda is saying and doing. More than that, you're conscious of what's going on in your own mind. Whatever your thoughts are, you are conscious of those thoughts. Whatever your emotions are, you are conscious or aware of those emotions. Whatever your eyes and ears, etc., pick up and convey to your mind, whatever your sense organs pick up, all of that is conveyed to your mind. All of that takes place in your mind. All of that is known to you. Why is it known to you? Because you are conscious. In fact, you are a conscious being. Guess what these two words mean? Conscious being. There you go. You are a conscious being. There's a whole lot more in these words, I admit. But we're going to give the short version, the simple version right now. Later in the text, we'll go into it in much more detail. You are a conscious being, which is full, complete. How about if we call it the source of happiness and joy? That's a nice way of putting it. You are a conscious being, chit, sat, who is Ananda, the source of joy, the source of contentment and peace, that inner source. Now, that consciousness is definitely different from your power of seeing, isn't it? In fact, you can have consciousness and not have the power of seeing. Think about a blind person. A blind person has eyeballs. A blind person does not have the power of sight, which is sukshma, but the blind person is still conscious. So in the absence of the power of sight consciousness continues to exist, what we're establishing is a distinction, the difference between Atma and Sukshma Sharira. Suppose, and this is just fun, we do this occasionally in our Vedanta classes, it would be nice to do it today in our Bhagavad Gita class, to differentiate between the conscious self, Atma, and Sukshma Sharira, all those powers which enliven your body. To differentiate it, we used an open-eye meditation, kind of an experiment, where I just asked you to imagine what it would be like if you were blind. Not just blind, but blind and deaf. Not just blind and deaf, but blind, deaf, and numb. Not dumb, that's another expression. Blind, deaf, and numb, head to toe. Imagine right now, if you were blind, deaf, and numb, what would you know about what was happening in this lecture hall? You wouldn't see anything. You wouldn't hear anything. You couldn't even feel anything if you were blind, deaf, and numb. What we're talking about symbolically is getting rid of these aspects of your sukshma sharira. Blind, deaf, and numb, it's as though sukshma sharira is removed, so to speak. What about your consciousness? The conscious being that you are. If you are blind, deaf, and numb, do you continue to exist as a conscious being? Now, think about the experience. You can't imagine being blind, deaf, and dumb right now. You can't see or hear anything going on. You can't feel anything. Are you still conscious? Yes. What are you conscious of? Think about it for a moment. What are you conscious of? Your mind would be spinning. You'd be wondering, what's going on? Why am I blind, deaf, and numb? And why can't I see anything? Why can't I hear anything? What's going on? Your mind would still be working. You would be conscious of your thoughts. You'd be conscious of emotions. You'd be conscious of the absence of sight. You'd be conscious of the absence of sound. But your consciousness would remain nonetheless. So we're trying to differentiate very clearly between sukshma sharira, those forces that enliven your body, those non-physical forces that enliven your body, and atma, the consciousness. Here's a nice simple definition: that by which all mental activities are known. Consciousness. That by which all mental activities are known. Please note, some of you are in a medical profession. Please note that our Vedantic use of the word consciousness is very different than the medical use. The medical use of the word consciousness means your ability to respond to the world. That's not our definition at all. So set that definition aside. Our definition, the Vedantic definition of consciousness, is that by which all your mental activities are known. So, now that we've got some clarity, we're going to talk about this much, much, much more. What is the nature of that consciousness, etc.? We have to discuss. We will a little bit at a time. We want to proceed in the text, but we need to get some clarity before we proceed. So, just to finish up this topic, do you remember at the end of the class I gave that very nice modern metaphor to understand these three? And this metaphor is introduced to show something. We say that which travels, when a stula sharira perishes, oh, isn't that a nice way to say things? When a stula sharira perishes, we call that a euphemism. Euphemism means a nice sounding expression. So instead of saying, when a stula sharira perishes, I should say, when you die, which is what we're talking about. When you die, when your physical body is no more functioning, then, let's ask the question, what happens to each of these? Well, according to our shastra, according to scripture, sukshma sharira is that which travels. The subtle body is that which travels. Remember, our definition of subtle body is all that enlivens your physical body. So it includes your prana, the life force. Doesn't include the physical organs, but includes the life force which makes those organs work. So that prana is part of the sukshma sharira, your powers, your physical powers, your powers of seeing, hearing, your sense powers are part of it, and all of your mental faculties are part of it. They all, as an entity called sukshma sharira, or loosely speaking, soul, although I prefer not to use that term. So that sukshma sharira is that which departs a physical body and travels to another physical body. Notice we haven't talked one word about atma. And this we're going to develop as we continue, but I'll give you the short answer right now. When the physical body dies and the sukshma sharira travels, what happens to atma? And the correct answer is nothing. What? Correct. And we're going to develop this. What happens to atma is absolutely nothing. Atma is utterly unaffected even by death. And we're going to see that in the coming verses. So just to complete this introduction, coming back to that metaphor that we concluded our last class, we said that the sthula sharira, physical body, is like your computer. Your computer is sitting on your desk. Your computer has a box, a chassis. It's like we have a box, we have a chassis. Your computer has a, if you opened up the chassis, you'd find a rectangular box with a fan in it. It's called the power supply. If you could open this one up, you'd find our power supply, the heart. So if you open up your computer box, you have all the wires. Imagine opening this one up. You see all the veins and arteries and nerves and ducts and all of that. So we have lots of wires inside. If you open up the computer, you have lots of different parts. Lots of different parts. If you find in a computer, there's one very special part called the CPU, the computer chip. Next to the computer chip are some rows of chips, memory. So inside your computer is lots of parts. All of that represents our physical body. The box represents your body, and all the parts inside the box represent all your organs. Clear enough? Then, your computer would be absolutely useless without software. And as I described at the end of the last class, on the hard, you know some computer stuff, I know, almost all of you can follow this stuff. On the hard drive in your computer are gigabytes and gigabytes of data and programs. Your hard drive weighs about 2 or 3 pounds. How much do all these gigabytes of data and program weigh? A gigabyte is 1 million million bytes. That is a lot. Is that right? 1 million million? 1,000 million. 1,000 million bytes. That's a lot. Should make it very heavy, right? The more data you put on your computer, the heavier it gets? No. Because data and programs are not sthula. Data and programs are sukshma. They're non-physical. Watch this. Because they're non-physical, they really don't exist. So some people who are critical of religion and spiritual traditions, they'll say, has anyone ever seen a sukshma sharira? No. Therefore, how do you know it exists? If you can't see it, it doesn't exist. What a ridiculous argument. If you can't see it, it doesn't exist. Has anyone ever seen Santa Claus? For real, not the actor. So, if you don't see Santa Claus, doesn't exist. What a ridiculous argument. all that exists is not physical and tangible and available to verify. Have you ever seen radio waves? They don't exist. Have you ever seen goodness? Not a good action. I'm not talking about good behavior or good action. I'm just talking about pure goodness. Goodness. Have you ever seen it? These are not physical, tangible things. So the argument is just because you don't see it, you can't conclude it doesn't exist. There are non-physical realities. So you don't see the bits in your computer, those gigabytes of data on a disk. If you were to open up your disk drive, you wouldn't see a thing. If you open up your disk drive, by the way, don't do it, you'll damage your computer. If you opened up the disk drive before and after storing gigabytes of data, you could not see any difference whatsoever. You couldn't see any difference. You couldn't weigh any difference. Okay, enough said. The data and programs on your computer are not physical. They're sukshma, but they certainly exist. Even more than that, they determine the personality of your computer. It's a funny expression. The computer program that's running on your computer determines its personality. What does Swamiji mean by that? Sometimes your computer has a personality of a web browser. Sometimes your computer has a personality of a word processor. Those are completely different personalities, right? Sometimes your computer behaves like a web browser. Sometimes your computer behaves like a word processor. Sometimes your computer behaves, especially if you've got teenagers around, it behaves like a game. These are completely different personalities. The software on your computer determines its behavior, determines its personality. The sukshma sharira inside our bodies determines our behavior, determines our personalities. Clear enough? And notice, as I suggested at the very end of the last class, that you could actually take a program and data from your computer at work and install it on a computer at home. Software and data can transmigrate from one computer to the next. And that's our metaphor. Just as computer and software can be transferred from one computer to another, in the same way, sukshma sharira can transmigrate from one physical body to the next. And the final point, before we return to our text, is that your computer, with all of its hardware and software, would be utterly useless if it weren't plugged in. Electricity is fundamental and essential to the function of your computer. And in the same way, consciousness is essential and fundamental to your existence as a conscious being. Before we leave this metaphor, can I just share with you one more funny connection or image? Suppose you go into like a university where they have a computer lab and you'll find dozens of computers in a row plugged in and operating. What's significant about it, every computer, they could be different brands. You know, some are Dell, some are IBM or whoever's making Lenovo. There we go. So different brands of computers. And, sorry for this. Some of the computers are made in the USA. Some of the computers are made in Japan or India. You get this one. This computer is made in USA. Many of these are made in India. That's the idea. You'll see if we can play with these metaphors and have fun. But there's something more serious coming. Those dozens of computers in the computer lab are all plugged in to the same source of electricity. If you know a little bit about electricity, you might know that the same electrons that enter one computer, electricity means a flow of electrons through wires. That's really what electricity is. Electrons move physically. they move through conductors, through wires. So the electrons that enter one computer enter the next computer, into the next computer, into the next computer. That's the way electricity works. If they're all plugged into the same circuit, so the electricity comes into one computer. If you notice that a plug has two prongs on, sometimes three, but at least two. So it comes in on one prong. This is not exactly technically correct, but give me a break. This is a metaphor. I don't want to teach you about electricity. That's not the point of this. But metaphorically, electricity enters one computer, comes out, and goes into the next computer, comes out, and goes into the next computer, all the way down the line. It's the same electricity that powers all of the computers. Quite a powerful metaphor, don't you think? Because the ancient rishis said that this Satchitananda Atma, the consciousness because of which you know your thoughts, the ancient rishis said there is one consciousness that pervades us all. The consciousness behind your thoughts and the consciousness behind my thoughts is one and the same consciousness. Just as one electricity powering all of the computers, in the same way, one consciousness, all-pervasive, boundaryless, limitless consciousness, present in your mind, in my mind, in every mind. All of this needs to be developed, and it will be in the coming verses. This is just an introduction to the current topic, so that we can be a little bit more clear about what we're seeing. All right, let's see a few verses. And I have a question which will tie into one of these verses. All right, back to verse 13. We saw the first half in the last class. Dehinosmin yata, just as. In fact, let's chant the verse. Dehinosmin yata, dehe. Dehinosmin yata. Kaumaram yauvanam jara. Kaumaram yauvanam. Tata dehantara praptir. Tata dehantara praptir. Dhirastatra namuhyati, dhirastatra yatha, just as, asmin dehe, in this body, which is dehinaha, which belongs to a person, which is invested with a dehi, sukshma sharira and atma. So just as, in this body, there is kaumaram, childhood, yauvanam, youth, and jara, old age. So childhood, youth, and old age is for which of these three entities? So let's be very, very clear about it. Atma, does Atma change with age? The one who knows your thoughts now and the one who knew your experiences when you were 1 year of age, when you were 1 year old, isn't it the same consciousness? Now, you don't remember what was going on at one, but the conscious being, Atma, that knows what's happening in your mind right now, that same conscious being, Atma, was present in you as a child, as an infant. So with age, Atma is utterly the same. Now, what about sukshma sharira? Does sukshma sharira age? It's a tricky question. Now, we gave the example of eyeballs being physical, power of sight being sukshma, and we know that as we age, we need these. We need glasses. Now, the fact that we need glasses, this is a very important question. Is it because our eyeballs are aging, or our powers of sight are aging? You actually need to know a little bit of medicine or anatomy to know this. It's actually your eyeball that's aging. Specifically, if you ask your eye doctor, he'll tell you that the muscles that control your eyes get weak with age and become less capable of focusing. That's why we need these. So it's not your power of sight that's aging. It's your eyeballs that are aging. Notice as we get older, we're not so strong as we were in our youth. Is it that the power of motion within us is weakening, or our muscles are growing weak? Let's be very clear that it is our bodies that are aging. Stula sharira is aging. We know that all too well. Our physical bodies are aging. Sukshma sharira does not age. It travels. It doesn't age. Which means the sukshma sharira that exists in your body is identical with the one with the sukshma sharira that existed in your prior body, whatever that may have been. The same sukshma sharira would travel to another body, whatever that might be. The point is, physical bodies age, sukshma sharira does not. Therefore, kaumaram, yauvanam, and jara, childhood, youth, and old age, belong to the physical body. Tata, in the same way, dehantara praptihi. In the same way, there is the acquisition of another body. When this body is no more, as we discussed, the sukshma sharira is said to travel to another body. There is the acquisition of another body. Dhiras tatra namuhyati tatra. With regard to this subject matter that we have spent quite a while introducing, with regard to this subject matter, tatra, dhiraha. Dhira has many meanings, one of which is wise person. So tatra, in this matter, dhiraha, a wise person, nah muhyati, is not confused. A wise person is not confused. Why? Knowing the distinction between stula sharira, sukshma sharira, and atma. All right, let's proceed. Matra sparshas tu kaunteya, matra sparshas tu count. Shitoshna sukha dukha daha, shitoshna sukha dukha. Agamapayino nityas, agamapayino nityas. Tansitikshasva bharata, tansitikshasva bharata. So Arjuna is addressed here, Kaunteya, son of Kunti. Matra sparshaha tu shita ushna sukadukadaha agama apayano anityaha tanstitikshasva bharata. Matra sparshas. Sparsha, literally touch, but here it means, in a more general sense, experience. Sparsha specifically means touch. Here it means experience. Experience of what? Of matra. Now you need to look at a commentary to understand how that word is used here. Matra, in Shankaracharya, explains it, miyate. That which is measured, that's the root of matra. That which is measured, meaning that which is perceived. We measure things with our eyes. How big is something? How small is something? How loud is something? How soft is something? How sweet is something? How hot is something? So with how heavy is something? With our five senses, we measure the world around us. That's why the word matra is used here. Matra sparshaha means all of our experiences. Whatever we experience of the world around us, whatever we experience by means of our five senses, and please note that everything we experience of the world around us is because of our five senses. That was the example before. If you're blind, deaf, and numb, and let's just add two more, you can't taste anything or smell anything. Those are the only two left, right? So if you're blind, deaf, and numb, you can't smell or taste, what possible information could you gain about the world around you? What contact, what knowledge, what experience of the world around you? None whatsoever. So it's clear then, our, watch this language, our only contact, and I use that word only very, very carefully, our only contact with the world around us is through our five senses. Matra sparshaha refer to all that we experience by means of our five senses. And what kinds of things are those? Shita, ushna, sukha, dukkha, daha. Daha, they give. Whatever our experiences are, those experiences are sukha, dukkha, daha. They give rise to happiness and suffering. Sukha, happiness, dukkha, suffering. Happiness and suffering like shita and ushna, like cold and heat. So notice, if it's 105 degrees out, then shita gives happiness. Coldness gives happiness. But when it's 10 degrees Fahrenheit, then shita, coldness gives sorrow, gives suffering. So all of our sense perceptions give rise to pleasure or pain, happiness or suffering, depending on what those sensations are. Sometimes it's too hot, sometimes it's too cold, etc., etc., etc. All right. So our experience of the world gives rise to pleasure and pain. We know that very well. So what? What is being taught here? Well, when it's too hot, what do people talk about? God, it's so hot. They go on complaining and complaining. It's so hot, it's so hot, it's so hot. Remember, I told this story long ago. My guru likes this story of a man and woman on a train journey in India. You remember this story? And it's a long, it's hot, and the wife is so thirsty, and she goes on complaining, I'm so thirsty, I'm so thirsty. He says, that's all right, dear, we'll get down at the next station and get some water, but I'm so thirsty. She goes on complaining kilometer after kilometer on his long train journey. They finally get to the station. He gets down, he gets some water, comes back on the train, they go on, and she's drinks a lot of water. And she continues to complain, I was so thirsty, I was so thirsty. So even after getting the water, she continues to complain. My guru's joke. So the problem is when we experience the world around us, we find that we have lots to complain about. We suffer. We suffer a lot. And just to get a little serious, when we our bodies are aging, disease and old age are inevitable for every one of us. We're going to be subject to lots of suffering. What is the solution to this problem? Look what Sri Krishna says here at the end. He says that all that you experience is agama and apayi. Agama, it comes. Apayi, it goes. Agama, apayinaha. All of these things, all of these experiences are coming and going. All of them are anityaha, impermanent. All of these experiences of both happiness and pain, experience of both sukha and dukkha, both of those experiences are anitya. They're impermanent, they're transient. Therefore, tanstitikshasva bharata. Bharata, he addresses Arjuna. Sri Krishna addresses Arjuna as a descendant of King Bharat. That's really what bharata means. Anyone from that lineage of King Bharat is bharata. So, O Arjuna, bharata, tan, those experiences of pleasure and pain, titikshasva, you should put up with them. You should tolerate them. You should accommodate them. And accommodate them without complaining like the lady on the train. Now, what does it mean to accommodate pain? The question, actually, there's a question in the question box. Please continue to put questions in that box. I'll take them up. So here the question relates very nicely. When I stub my toe, Do I observe the pain and just observe it? Or does enduring the pain mean something else? So when you stub your toe, you get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and bang, happens. So you stub your toe. It's throbbing and throbbing and throbbing. Picture that. Maybe it's happened to you. And here, Sri Krishna says, Tanstatikshasva. Put up with it. Accommodate it. Tolerate it. Imagine laying in bed with the toe throbbing and throbbing and throbbing. And to make matters worse, you have an important meeting tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. You're not able to sleep because your toe is throbbing. So not only are you suffering because of your throbbing toe, you're now worrying about how you're ever going to get enough rest, show up at the important meeting tomorrow, and do a good job. How miserable is that? And then Sri Krishna says, oh, you just have to put up with it. How? And here, there's something that's just beginning to be developed here. This will be developed throughout the Bhagavad Gita, but let me show you a very important point that's being made here. On what basis can you tolerate throbbing pain? Well, let's come back here. Throbbing pain belongs to whom? Certainly, your bloody and bruised toe is tula sharira. But pain is conveyed through your nervous system. Right? Conveyed through your nervous system to your brain, and your brain responds to the signals sent by the nerves in your foot. And the brain and nervous system are part of sukshma sharira. Now watch this. Atma, as we said before, that conscious being, is that by which all mental events are known. This language is very technical, but it's quite helpful. A mental event is whatever happens in your mind. Mental events include thoughts. Mental events include emotions. Mental events include memories. Mental events include sense perceptions. Because whatever comes to your eyes and ears ends up in your mind, correct? So it ends up as a mental event. If I'm speaking, every one of my words enters your ear, but it ends up in your mind as a mental event. So mind is part of that sukshma sharira as well. So whatever happens in your mind are all mental events. They are all known by consciousness. Now, we're leading up to something very important. The toe is bloody and bruised, stula sharira. The sensation of pain is traveling through your nervous system from your toe to your brain, sukshma sharira. Where does Atma come into this formula? So Atma, consciousness. Consciousness means you. You are that conscious being. Be very clear about it. You are a conscious being. You possess a body, a physical body. In fact, you possess a sukshma sharira as well. You possess the power of sight and hearing. You possess a mind. In fact, that's why we say that you can only lose what you have. People say, oh, I lost my mind. You can only lose what you possess. You're not your mind. You possess a mind. Well, who is the you that possesses a mind? Who is the you that possesses a sukshma sharira? Is that conscious being, satchit. And when sounds enter your ear, consciousness illumines. When sights enter your eyes and then becomes present in your mind, consciousness illumines whatever is happening in your mind. Illumines like light shining on me. I'm going to make a very important point, and we'll close our class on this important point. This light shines on me, reveals what I'm doing. If I stand on my head, which would be very peculiar, I'm not going to. If I stand on my head, how is the light affected? If I stand upwards or if I do shirasasana, the light is unaffected. So when consciousness, when your consciousness illumines your thoughts, if you think about a cow or a donkey, how does it affect consciousness? If light shines on me, if I'm standing upwards or upside down, it doesn't affect the light. If consciousness is shining in your mind, revealing a thought about a cow or revealing a thought about a donkey, it doesn't make any difference to consciousness. Consciousness reveals whatever is there. Finally, we can make the point. When pain is present in your mind, that pain is revealed by consciousness. And that consciousness is utterly unaffected by the pain in your mind. The pain is there. The pain is in your mind. The pain is in your inexperience. But that pain is revealed, that mental event called pain, is revealed by consciousness. And just like this light is unaffected by what it shines upon, in the same way, your consciousness is utterly unaffected by what it reveals. Now, we're just beginning this topic. There's a lot more that needs to be unfolded to make this real. And one thing I want to talk about in maybe in the next class is that this is not a matter of belief. This is something to be understood, something to be perfectly, personally discovered. Here, Sri Krishna tells Arjuna, "Tams tatikshasva." You just have to accommodate all those painful problems of life. This is not like advice. This is a spiritual teaching. There is a way to be utterly free from suffering in life. And that way to be free from suffering is just beginning to be unfolded in this verse. So we leave it at this point with treated like a hypothesis. Sri Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita and the teachings of Vedanta say that consciousness, your consciousness, is utterly unaffected by the experience of pain. When we meet next time, we're going to return to that very point and explore it and find out how can that possibly be. So we'll do that when we meet next time. And some important announcements at the end of our class. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our children's class at 11. Oh, tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock, we have a new program I'd like to invite you to. We sometimes do bhajans and sing stotras. We're doing something different on Sunday. We're calling it a musical meditation, swara upasana. We're going to use bhajans and stotra, not just for singing, but for meditation. So it'll be done, the tempos will be slow, it'll be a more meditative mood, and there'll be brief intervals of meditation. Meditation while you're chanting or singing. So there'll be meditation woven into the program. So that swara upasana meditation, musical meditation, will be tomorrow at 6 p.m. Oh, January 1st is coming, New Year's Day, and I've talked to several people about how we should schedule our programs that weekend, because Saturday is December 31st and Sunday is January 1st. So there are several ways that we can structure our programs, and I'd like some feedback before I make a decision. I just wanted to check in with you. We'll take a show of hands. I've noticed before, whenever we take a show of hands, it's 50-50. In this case, I have three options, in which case I expect a third of your hands for each one of the three options, but let's find out. We're going to take a show of the hands. The three options are, one, celebrate New Year's Day on December 31st. Option one, don't raise your hands yet and hear all three. Option two, celebrate New Year's Day on New Year's Day. That's novel. But canceling the Saturday class, so cancel Saturday and have only the celebration of New Year's Day on Sunday. Third option would be to have a normal Saturday class and to celebrate New Year's Day on New Year's Day. So these are the three options. And to help make a decision, we'll ask your feedback right now. Who would like to celebrate New Year's Day on December 31st, Saturday? Okay, a few of you. Who would like to celebrate New Year's Day on January 1st and then cancel the Saturday class? A show of hands, please. Okay. And how many of you would like to have a normal Saturday class and a celebration of New Year's Day? That's pretty obvious. Okay. Out of respect to you, I just wanted to make sure that it wouldn't be too much for you to come 2 days in a row. So we'll definitely go ahead and do that. We'll have a normal Saturday class and we'll celebrate New Year's Day on New Year's Day. Thanks for your feedback. Oh, final announcement is we have some outdoor project set up. We have leaves to pick up, mostly leaves to pick up, a few other jobs. So if you'd like to stay back, I hope you would have some warm coat to wear. It's a little chilly today. But if you can stay back, we'd like to have a group of maybe 20 volunteers stay back and remove some leaves. We have some food for you, so it's not like you have to work and get really hungry. So if you're able to stay back and help maybe for an hour to remove leaves, if you're able to stay back, why don't you, after we're done with RIT, please meet in the old hall, and then the project will be coordinated there. We appreciate your help. We'll conclude with our prayers and RIT.